you know, we sat around and kind of did a pros and cons list. And, you know, the pros were all the things you can learn from, you know, starting a business. And even one being like, if it does fail, like at least we have an interesting story to tell in an interview at a business school, where we didn't really have an interesting story to tell otherwise. Like playing lacrosse, going to work at reinsurance, or selling commercial real estate, what Chris did, going to, like, that's not a great story. But, you know, starting a business and running into the ground, that's a story.
Hello and welcome, everyone. I am Jory Calkins, the founder and CEO of Enduring Companies and the host of Built to Outlast, a podcast and community for business builders by business builders. We explore the journeys and companies of business builders in America with a focus on traditional small to mid-sized business niches and the strategies which enable them to endure and flourish. If you are building a business now or aspire to build one in the future, this is for you. To join the Built to Outlast community and access episodes, show notes, and other community resources to support your journey, please visit builttooutlast.com. If you have or know a business that may be sold and care who the buyer is, or if you want to buy or build a business and care who you do it with, please visit enduring.co to learn more about us, our long-term approach, and our holding company. Welcome, everyone. For our show today, we're speaking with Matt Wheeler, who's a friend and the co-founder of Sports Recruits, which is a technology platform focused on empowering student athletes to pursue their dreams. Welcome to the show, Matt.
Thanks for having me, Jory.
Well, we've known each other for a long time. I'm excited to have this conversation for, if no other reason than a stroll down memory lane, but you've been doing a lot over the last many years since we last connected. So I'm excited to hear about that. But like each of these conversations, I'd love to just start with, you know, I know some of this background, but hear about and learn about your background, whether you want to start at hour one or day one or month one or year one or decade one. Where are you from and what is kind of the foundation for your life so far?
So Jory and I went to high school together in Connecticut, about an hour or so from New York City. And I grew up in a town, a few towns over from where we went to high school. And I generally like to trace my entrepreneurial history to, you know, the proverbial lemonade stand, which I would run in the summers with my siblings and cousins up in Rhode Island, in Musquamacan, where we go for the summer. And I kind of had a knack for being able to put together different kids from the neighborhood to make sure the lemonade stand was always running. So when I ended up starting a business all those years later, you know, people I've known since I was, you know, 3, 4, 5 years old would always laugh saying, "Oh, this reminds me of the lemonade stand that you had, you know, way back when on Maplewood Avenue."
So tell me about that. Tell me about the lemonade stand. So what was it actually like a lemonade stand? Were you selling actual lemonade?
Well, I mean, my memory is we would always have lemonade in the fridge, Crystal Light, which you might have had. It was, you know, really refreshing, probably way too sugary for kids these days, would not probably make the cut in the Wheeler refrigerator now. And I assume at some point I thought, well, you know, all these families have to walk by our house on the way to the beach. They're probably thirsty, so we should sell them some lemonade. And an interesting thing that would happen would be this beach is a beach that doesn't have any, there's no like tiki bars or anything on the beach. So you don't really bring any money to the beach. So, you know, we started to have to run like house accounts almost where, you know, there would kind of be like an IOU of sorts. And then someone would remember the next Saturday they go to the beach or something to bring the $5 they owe the Wheeler kids on Maplewood Avenue. And so I got a reputation for putting the kids in the neighborhood to work. And, you know, while I was building my empire and counting the money in the back of the house or something.
I have so many questions about the lemonade stand now. Were the house accounts, like, would anyone ever pre-fund? Was it ever working capital positive, or were you always negative? Were you always like extending credit to people?
No, it was always a matter of like the neighborhood was so small that like I was going to see these people. So no one's going to skip out on a bill. But then we, there's a golf course we butt up on. So we'd go over and find a lot of golf balls and we'd package them up in egg crates. And so you could buy a dozen golf balls as well. And a family friend who is still a family friend today would always buy these dozens of golf balls. They were sold for like $5, which back in the day was a lot of money. And literally like 4 or 5 years ago, I found out that he actually doesn't even golf. And he would just buy the golf balls because he thought it was kind of a cool little thing we were doing. And so I always thought, man, this is great. He just has this never-ending supply of golf balls. And it turns out he was just, you know, doing a solid for the neighborhood kids. Any time he would go by, he'd buy a dozen golf balls for $5.
That's great. I mean, gross margins on that were probably about 100%, right? If you get the free golf balls for free and the egg cartons for free, you're running pretty nice gross margins.
I mean, it's good money. It's good money, no taxes.
Tell me about kind of like recruiting. We'll get to a different interpretation of recruiting, but I'd love to hear about your recruiting of, you know, folks to work the lemonade stand. What do you think it was? Like, what of all the things you could have been doing with your time, why was it like putting together the patchwork of friends and family and cousins to like man the lemonade stand? Why was that what you were doing?
I mean, I think when you're, and I don't know, I guess we'll see if, you know, back in the day, my parents kind of just like, you just get let loose in the neighborhood. And so, you know, there's only so much like riding bikes you can do. There's only so much like going to the local like kind of convenience store to buy, you know, candy you probably shouldn't be eating. And so I would assume it was a half between just kind of bored of doing those things and half out of necessity to raise more funds to go buy more candy. And so, you know, if I needed to kind of scale my operation, I needed some good labor. And so I had my brother and I had my, you know, my cousins, and there's a whole clan of kids that were all about the same age. And so, you know, I guess they were probably bored too. And they say, well, this, you know, this guy seems to have it all figured out. We'll go work his lemonade stand and make a few bucks. So I can go to Shorecrest down the street and buy some more candy.
So do you feel like you had it all figured out, or were you faking it till you made it with the lemonade stand? Like where were they reading it right? Or were you reading it right? What was the...
No, I think we had a good thing going. You could get some iced tea as well. And I don't know, this is just a summer thing, you know, every summer you get a year older. And so I assume eventually I just aged out of that. And then I went and worked at the golf club nearby. So I went and caddied, which I think, you know, is somewhat relevant to this conversation. I think, you know, caddying if you don't know that, is essentially carrying someone else's golf bags around a golf course for 4 to 5 hours. You know, I think that was a really valuable lesson in leadership, and also just meeting lots of people that have done lots of cool things with their lives. And, you know, where else do you get to spend like 5 hours with somebody, like, you know, face to face? You know, even this day and age, how often do you get to spend 5 hours with someone that, I don't know, is some like, you know, private equity titan or, you know, huge Hollywood agent or whatever it might be? So I always, whenever I speak to anyone looking for a job in that high school age, I say, you know, if there's a country club nearby and you can go and caddy, I mean, it's such a good experience to meet people that will probably help you in some capacity as you go through high school and beyond.
It's funny you bring that up. I've had at least two other guests on who were caddies when they were younger, and it was very formative for them. I'd love to hear, you shared a little bit, but are there a few specific experiences or anecdotes from that you remember, you know, today that were kind of formative for you, or important relationships, or impacted, you know, your trajectory?
Well, yeah, we started the business in 2008. I mean, the world hadn't completely fallen apart, but there were some signs that things were going great. But, you know, when we were kind of passing around the hat, trying to raise literally any amount of money, if you wanted to give us $1,000, we were more than happy to take it. There was kind of a block of guys that threw in some money that, you know, the conversations were, we had this whole business plan that you could read if you wanted to, but the conversations were traditionally, yeah, cool, you're starting a business, how much would you like? Okay, that seems reasonable, like pretty much talk to this person and it'll get you that money. And obviously roll the tape back, it was more of a, you know, they were betting on the person they knew, since they were, you know, I was 13 and started caddying for them. So I caddied for them for a solid, let's call it, until I was 20 or so, 7 years. The idea was almost meaningless to them. It was more that they knew me well enough, and they probably saw my work ethic on the golf course, that they checked the box that at least he's going to work hard at this, whether this idea is a good one or not. And, you know, our currently one of our larger investors is one of these guys I caddied for. And, you know, we won some club championships. We, in air quotes, he won some club championships. I happened to be carrying the bag. I probably read a good putter too, but when you're that level of golfer, you don't really need me. But yeah, I mean, to this day, he's one of our biggest supporters. And, you know, kind of that, I guess that relationship, you know, obviously just developed, you know, over the course of summers, you know, kind of running around the golf course.
That's awesome. I don't know if that qualifies as like a tip, but for 7 years of carrying the bag, having a great seed investor, you know, a great seed investor that comes out of that, that's a pretty good return on invested effort for sure.
Yeah. I mean, think about it though, like you're stacking, again, there's different, it all depends, you know, there's different clubs of different shapes and sizes, but like, if you're talking about a concentration of people who have been successful in, you know, whatever their pursuit is, you know, being around some of these clubs, you're kind of stacking the deck in your favor of, you know, kind of interesting, successful people that you can, you're not going to just run into on the street. But then, yeah, like I said, if you do start carrying their golf bag, you're going to spend a lot of time together. And so, yeah, I really look back on that time with, you know, obviously a lot of great memories. And then obviously a lot of, you know, kind of good mentorship and kind of guidance, you know, on our kind of professional journey here.
So tell me a little bit more about, you mentioned that, you know, that individual and it sounded like a number of others observed in you work ethic. How did that manifest itself when you were, was it just like you carried the bag faster or what, you know, or you were doing more loops or like what, tell me more about why that you think they perceived that in you?
Well, I guess I was always around. You know, so like I theoretically could be at the beach. I didn't have to be at this, you know, golf club, or I could have done, you know, one loop on a Saturday. But if I came back around and there was another loop to be had, I would generally do that loop, especially if I'm just walking off the course and walking right back on it, which they call it the old double dip is what we called that back in the day in the caddy room. So yeah, I was always around. And so, you know, generally these guys were coming up on the weekends because they were working wherever they were working. And then they're coming up there on the weekends in the summer. And so, you know, I was always around. So I guess, you know, there's probably some part of them understanding that, well, you know, it's not like he's here one weekend, gone the next, like every weekend he's here. And I personally liked just being around the camaraderie of generally the group playing. You know, obviously I'm on the outside of that group, but a lot of conversations are happening just amongst that group about whatever business they happen to be in. And you get to just be this fly on the wall. A lot of times you don't really know what they're talking about. Obviously, I don't know the ins and outs of different business dealings that are being discussed, but you can still be a fly on the wall. And maybe over the course of weeks, you start to put together kind of some puzzle pieces, especially if something's in motion, you can kind of see actually the thing actually develop over the course of a few weeks. And so, yeah, I guess. And you also learn just how to like interact with, you know, senior people, which I think is you know, a good example would be, you know, if there's a putt to be had, which again, this isn't life or death, but like if there's a putt to be had and I think it's going to go right and they think it's going to go left, you know, obviously I can change my opinion and say, well, okay, if you think it's going to go left and now I think it's going to go left, or I can stick to the fact that I think it's going to go right, you think it's going to go left. I'm going to stick to my, I think it's going to go right. You're going to stick to your, you think it's going to left. Ultimately, you just decide where you want to putt it. But we'll all get to watch to see whether it's going to go right or it's going to go left. And so I think there's a lot of little moments like that where, you know, again, depending on the golfer, they want different levels of input. But, you know, kind of standing your ground and you know, kind of like, again, this is like researching is the stretch here, but you know, kind of not waffling on things you might believe in. I think there are times where there's plenty of opportunities when you're young in your career to just kind of like do whatever the superior thinks is the right thing to do. And ultimately, it's probably not going to work out great for that company if the young people in the company are just doing whatever the old people want them to. Older people, I should say.
That's fascinating and a super interesting. I mean, in terms of almost like software lingo that you can A/B test a bunch of different behaviors on the course with a bunch of different people that you're working with, right? You can like one loop, you can actually speak up, the other loop, you don't, you know, you see how it goes. You know, there's a bunch of different behaviors. Obviously I believe it sounds like you do too, that it's better to, you know, speak up and express your opinion and then see where it goes. But it's kind of a fascinating testing ground for all that behavior, especially as a younger kid, you know, just learning how to interact with adults.
Yeah, I mean, I think that's the. It's funny to like obviously now think of the alternative is like someone being their face being buried in their phone, like a 17-year-old me being buried in my phone, which I probably would have been. I mean, obviously there would have been that distraction that we fortunately didn't have. But I mean, I think even more so, you know, in this day and age, like getting outside and going, I think it's an awesome job. I'm going to definitely encourage my kids to, when we get to that age, to consider it as something that they should do in some capacity. Cause it's, my brother ended up caddying, my cousins would all, so like all those people that were working with me in the lemonade stand all ended up coming over and caddying. And so there's kind of a little kind of like line of us that ended up caddying, which is pretty fun.
So did you recruit them all over to caddy? It feels like you're the, and maybe this is leading to your destiny, your future destiny, but maybe you're like the master recruiter.
Well, it's also really good money too. So it didn't take very long to be like, yeah, I went over and did this and made X amount of dollars in cash. Like eventually, it beat the alternative of going and working at the, ice cream shop on the beach or whatever the alternatives were at that age, mowing lawns, or I don't even know what the other options were. You know, when you get to be out on a beautiful golf course in the sun, it's you're not sitting on the beach, but at least you're out in the sun and you can see the ocean. It's pretty good.
Yeah, for sure. What kind of ages were you when you were doing that? Is that, probably not 5 years old, but like late single digits to teens?
I started when I was like 13 or 14. And then I did it in the summers until I think the summer before my senior year, I got like a real internship at ESPN in Bristol. And the summer before that, I went study abroad. So that summer was kind of a wash. But yeah, I think pretty much until that summer before my junior year, that was my summer kind of gig, going back to Musquamakit and caddying for the summer, which was, just again, you're still right near the ocean. So pretty hard to beat.
Yeah, that's awesome. Tell me about some of those internships along the way too. I guess before we get to there, were there other experiences you had growing up that you feel like were formative to you and to your entrepreneurial or just life journey in general?
You know, my dad's entrepreneurial. He's done some exciting stuff in the kind of media space. And so, it's kind of funny to think back though, like when you're in high school, like you don't really necessarily have a great handle on what all of your parents and your friends' parents are doing. Obviously you have so much going on in your own life, but there were different events. Like there was a product called Dow Jones Video that my dad launched. I remember going and Mike Bloomberg was there and thinking that was pretty cool. Like Mike Bloomberg is in, obviously Bloomberg over the years became fabulously wealthy with his own product. But yeah, I think there was, seeing some of the stuff my dad did professionally gave me some of the, when it did come to thinking of starting a company, which didn't necessarily happen in an organic way. It wasn't like how things happen these days where people just all want to start companies. Like I didn't necessarily think that was going to be my route when I left college. But when kind of the opportunity presented itself, I think I had the background to make it seem like a more reasonable thing than maybe some others would have.
Were there other kind of like vignettes or observations you had growing up, like that video launch where Mike Bloomberg was there, that kind of like stick in your mind either now or in retrospect or even at the time, that were like, oh, this might, my dad's doing something kind of different and interesting?
Yeah, it was always like, always fun visiting, we're for NBC for a time and like visiting your Rock Center and, seeing all the energy and all the thing happening around there. And so you have those little snapshots, like you said, vignettes is probably a better word. And you look back on them, as you kind of try to make sense of your own journey. But I think the thing that when it did come around, potentially starting this business, my business partner and I, kind of brought it to my dad for feedback and kind of like can you thoroughly beat this business plan up and tell us all the things that are wrong about it? And so, I guess even before kind of the company was incorporated, we were, kind of leaning on, some of the experience I had within my family to kind of think through whether this is a good idea or a bad idea or somewhere in between.
Yeah, that's awesome. Well, so maybe let's fast forward then to where we bookmarked before and talk about some of the internships. So you were caddying and getting some great experience there in a number of different ways. And then you started having some of these internships to add to that experience. So what sorts of things were you doing? You said ESPN. I know, growing up with you, you were very into sports and an athlete as well. So can you weave kind of that part of the picture together?
Yeah, I played lacrosse at Wesleyan in Middletown, Connecticut. Bill Belichick's alma mater would probably be and on one side, and then Lin-Manuel Miranda on the other. Into the Heights was actually his senior thesis. He was a few years older than me. I was not hanging out in the same circles as Lin was. I was more on the athlete side of the campus, and Lin was more on the artsy side of the campus. But yes, I had good experience playing lacrosse at Wesleyan. And so before my senior year, I did an internship at ESPN. I actually lived on campus in Middletown, and then would just shoot up to Bristol. And it was similar to kind of a lot of internships. You kind of just rotate around different groups. But this was more on like the production side of the ESPN operation. And so, you know, everything from, again, this was back with tapes, but like you literally had people whose job it was, and you rotate through these jobs where you'd sit and like Jory would be in charge of watching the Cincinnati versus Cubs baseball game. Matt's in charge of watching the Yankees versus Red Sox game. And you had rooms of people. So that was like one rotation. And another part of the rotation is like being in the actual control room where, you know, you have this game's running long and this game's supposed to start, and they need to somehow seamlessly communicate to the people that are coming to watch this game, where they can find this game as this game finishes, and all the moving pieces around that. And thinking back, it was actually pretty crazy to think kind of how high tech ESPN was. This was in summer of 2004. Obviously now it's a whole different ballgame with the facilities they've built in Bristol, but it was definitely just fun as a consumer of sports to work in an environment that, or just kind of be in the belly of the beast and see how all this stuff actually gets on the TV, you know, down to like meeting the person who was like literally writing the stuff that you see on the bottom line. And so I think that internship definitely gave me appreciation for like, even like everything takes work. It doesn't matter whether you're ESPN size or a little startup like us, like, those words don't get to the bottom line just magically. Like someone has to do that. And so I think that was a good learning lesson of, you know, things that you just kind of watch TV and just seemingly think, oh, these things probably just happen. Well, no, none of this just happens. Like something, there's a whole team of people doing all this work that you're never going to see or hear from. But
sorry to interrupt, but was there anything in that experience, you mentioned a few, that stands out to you as like, this is way higher tech or way lower tech or not what I expected at all one way or the other before you step foot in Bristol or at
not
ESPN's
really,
building?
I think I just, you know, gained an appreciation for how seemingly things that might just to you seem like running water or like kind of just like oxygen in some respects. Like there's a lot of work that goes into all of those, you know, all those shows. I mean, even like this kind of like sounds silly, but like they would get a feed of like PTI. PTI would come in, it's taped, and it might be my job that day to like take the feed in from PTI and mark where the different segments end, because in literally an hour and a half, someone needs to take those marks and insert all the advertisements. So like I would watch PTI or the Around the Horn feed come in. I'd mark up where the segments end. I don't even remember if it was on a computer or whether I was doing it by hand and passing it on, but like in two hours, this was like 3 o'clock at 5:30, that was going on TV and there were ads being put where I said ads should be put. And that, even like that kind of like blew my mind. I'm like, well, what if I have a fat finger and I put a 7 instead of a 2 or something? but you know, I there was probably some checks and balances that maybe I wasn't even aware of. And I was just the first step of this kind of train here. But yeah, I mean, I think this happens in our business today where there are a lot of things that, you know, that are manual for whatever reason. And, you know, sometimes that's just how it is. And you might want to automate everything, but, you know, sometimes things, that's just not how the process was developed.
Yeah. Super interesting, especially to see how the sausage gets made. So you had that internship, and then I know you were an athlete, obviously, as you said, up through college. Did you go right into sports recruits, or you had a few things that you did as well before you jumped?
Quick stop in corporate America, working at a company called Guy Carpenter, which is a company under Marsh & McLennan. Marsh is a big insurance broker, and Guy Carpenter is a reinsurance broker, which I didn't know much of until a kid who was in my fraternity graduated 2 years before me, went to work there at a school. And so again, as you start to figure out what you're going to do after school, you generally tap your network of friends from your school or otherwise. And he was someone that you know, we had a really good time together and got along well in college. And so he said, "I think this could be a good role for you." And I studied up on reinsurance, which for the listeners on this call, insurance companies also buy insurance, so everyone buys insurance. And so obviously I learned enough through my friend Adam to, you know, ace the interview and get the job. And so I worked in their New York office from August of 2005, when I graduated college, through April 1st, 2008, which is when I left to start the business. So I had a little taste of corporate America.
You know, there's pluses and minuses for everyone. What did you feel like were the positives and negatives of corporate America versus how you're made up?
Well, I think I had a boss that was pretty demanding, which in hindsight was, I think, really a good learning ground for starting our business. She was, you know, very detail oriented and, like, you know, really didn't let anything slide. And I think that was good for a 22-year-old. You know, I think you kind of have to do that with you know, younger talent, because, you know, if you let this slide, then, you know, obviously what's next. I think the challenge was, you know, my college friend actually was in my group. And so we were in a group where we're part of the business where our business was very transactional, in the sense that, you know, if Jory was on the team, you could pretty easily trace back the amount of revenue Jory was bringing in versus Matt versus Joey versus whoever. And it became, like, pretty apparent to me pretty quickly that there were, you know, some younger team members that for whatever reason were bringing in, you know, potentially significantly more revenue than some of the more senior people. And I didn't have to be a rocket scientist to figure out that the compensation wasn't in line with that necessarily. And so that kind of grinded my gears. But I think that if you zoom back to that time, you know, traditionally what most people did, and I think Jory, you might've done this exactly to the T, which is you kind of work for 2 years and you go to business school. And so that was kind of how I thought of this little stop anyway, is I was going to work for 2 years. And I was in the process of taking my GMATs when we kind of came up with this business idea. And so it wasn't like I didn't give the job kind of like a fair shot, but, like, in that environment, like, that's what we were doing, is you're kind of using your first job to get your feet under you, kind of hopefully mature a little bit. And then you go off to business school, and then, you know, that propels you into your next, you know, whatever your next chapter might be. So I didn't have anything against the job or the role or the team members there. I just kind of knew that this was going to be a place where I was going to learn as much as I can, and then hopefully, you know, go off to school and then kind of, like, maybe expand the aperture of opportunities I might have had.
Yeah. Plus you were interested or you were used to being the organizer of the lemonade stand, not the frontline worker of the lemonade stand, you know, the captain of your own ship.
Yeah. I mean, I think if you interviewed my first boss, I feel like that's probably what she would say, is that, you know, Matt had kind of his way of doing things that might not have been the way I wanted it, but I was the boss, not him. I think that's probably what her feedback would have been, even though we might have gotten the same place. But yeah, I mean, I think that. And I was, you know, Chris, my co-founder, we were both captains of our lacrosse team at Wesleyan, where we played together. And so, yeah, I mean, there's definitely a little bit of that going on, I'm sure, is that.
It sounds very similar to feedback I've gotten. Not necessarily a bad thing, you know. So tell me, you started going into it. I'd love to hear. So you're working at Guy Carpenter, you're, you know, thinking about what's next. And then you and, is it Chris is your co-founder? You all, it sounds like, knew each other, but what, you know, how did this idea come about, and what was the spark that started it going?
So Chris was a little ahead of me in his journey of taking his GMATs and applying to school. So he had his GMATs taken and said, "Well, I'm going to move to Utah and get some skiing in before this next chapter of my life unfolds." And while he was out there, he was literally shooting lacrosse balls on a net at the local kind of college there. And someone was riding by on a bike or something and stopped and said, "Hey, did you play lacrosse in college?" And he said, "Yeah, I'm from Long Island. I played lacrosse in college." And they said, "Great. Well, we need a coach for this team. Do you want to come coach?" And he said, "Well, wasn't necessarily part of my plan, but yeah, that would be fun." So he started coaching and was kind of blown away by, one, the talent, which Utah is not, there's more talent there now than there was then, but wasn't known as a hotbed for lacrosse, where being from Connecticut or Long Island, you know, that's, you know, Long Island especially is really where so much talent comes out of. So we started working with a lot of these families who were thinking of playing lacrosse in college. And he was amazed that the process hadn't evolved. This was 2007, fall of 2007. Hadn't evolved at all since we were doing it in 99, 2000. The only difference was you might send a DVD now instead of sending a VHS tape. So he was like, this can't be, there has to be. You know, at this point, we had YouTube, Facebook was around, email was more widely used. So there has to be a better way. Like, and so we started poking around and realizing that there wasn't. And then he thought, well, maybe this is just a Utah thing. Maybe like when I go back home to Long Island, I talk to the family from, you know, Massapequa or whatever, you know, they're going to have it all figured out. And so he goes back home and during the holidays, and it turns out, no, like they're still just sending DVDs in the mail and like crossing their fingers. And so he said, you know, wrote me this long email in October of 2007 saying like, hey, I think like there's an opportunity here to like bring this whole process online. And, you know, all the families I speak to say they would love if there was a product like that, they'd be willing to pay for it. And again, right at that moment, I was, you know, literally taking my GMAT classes at Manhattan, whatever that GMAT school is in the city.
Manhattan GMAT.
Yeah. And so, you know, I already had kind of made that decision that I was going to go off to business school. So, you know, we sat around and kind of did a pros and cons list. And, you know, the pros were all the things you can learn from, you know, starting a business. And even one being like, if it does fail, like at least we have an interesting story to tell in an interview at a business school, where we didn't really have an interesting story to tell otherwise. Like playing lacrosse and going to work at reinsurance or selling commercial real estate, what Chris did, and going to, like, that's not a great story. But, you know, starting a business and running into the ground, that's a story. So we figured that's that's in the pro side. And then the cons, like we were 24, neither of us were in relationships. We didn't have any kids or anything. So we couldn't really find any cons. And so, we decided to go for it. And yeah, my last day was April 1st, 2008. I think my boss thought I'd lost my mind when I said I was going to start a company, because this was, you know, again, the spring of 2008. People were like starting companies, like the world was falling apart. And I was like leaving a job that was paying me money to go and get paid $0. So in hindsight, I probably was insane, or maybe she was right to think I was insane, but, you know, whatever, it all worked out.
I don't know. I think a lot of people can look at the same set of facts and decide whether it's in the pro or the con column, right? And I love how you both looked at, we could start a business and run it into the ground, and that would, at the very least, be educational and be in the like the pro side of the column. A lot of people would look at that as like, that's a negative side of the column, whereas you all had both the setup and the mindset to have that at the very least be a learning experience and, you know, be able to put that in the pro side of the column, which is like a very powerful footing to start something from, you know?
But I think it was also just a, and we both were on the, like, I was going to move out of the city, where I was going to move back into my parents in Darien. Chris was going to move from Utah out to move into my parents in Connecticut. My sister was at school, my brother was at school. So, you know, my parents had room. And so I think we were, because we were so young, we were kind of committed to like, we can do that lifestyle. It wasn't like we even had friends or coworkers to like compare it to, because like no one was starting businesses. So it wasn't like we were thinking that like someone had started this really successful business, and if we did it and we failed, we were going to be like benchmarked against this friend that started a business and it's wildly successful. Like there was no comp to what we were doing. So it was kind of like a wide open field almost, where anything we do is going to be kind of cool to, you know, all of our friends and family, because, you know, no one was doing something like this. So we kind of had that going for us as well, which is like any, you know, amount of success is pretty cool considering there's no real like yardstick to measure us versus.
Yeah, that's awesome. And what an awesome mindset to like build from. So what was step one? You know, you guys have mentally committed to taking a leap. What was step one, or what was product one? Like where did you go when you went from zero to one? What did that look like?
Yeah. So the genesis of the product was a platform that was going to help you get your information and video to coaches. And so instead of going to the post office and physically putting a DVD in the mail or a VHS tape in the mail, you would log into our product and you would say, I want to communicate with Dartmouth, and you'd write your message, you'd click send, and boom, the Dartmouth staff would get an email from you that would have the message you wrote and a link to your video in it. And that was at the base level, that was what we were trying to achieve. And neither of us were technical or are technical, so we used it, did a little RFP process and had a few kind of web. I mean, this is so long ago that like the people that were bidding on these were like literally like website development, like people that would just make websites. I mean, now you call them like agencies, or there's probably fancier terms for them. But we got a few bids and settled on one, and we essentially just drew out freehand how we envisioned this product looking based off of other web products we've used. We would sent off these kind of like this 10, 20, 30 page drawn. Here's what the profile looks like. Here's what the messaging system looks like. Here's what the video section looks like. Here's what the school section looks like. And, over the course of 2 or 3 months, like the product kind of came alive. They would show us something. This is in early 2018. And we would, send them back feedback, or this is wrong, this is right. And then in the summer of 2008, Lacrosse Recruits, which was the, we originally just focused on one sport. So we thought, we can get to that later, but we thought we were going to make sports specific communities, because we thought that lacrosse players would want to be in Lacrosse Recruits, and volleyball players would be in Volleyball Recruits, baseball players. So we were like GoDaddy kingpins, owned all these URLs. So we launched in the summer of 2018, and nobody bought. And so that was a problem. But what we figured out pretty quickly was that people weren't buying not because they thought the idea was bad or they didn't think that the product would be useful. They weren't buying because they didn't have any video. So we assumed wrongly that, again, this was 2008 versus when we were playing in 99, 2001. We figured like people now filmed games, like this is just film was just going to be around. And so it took us 18 months to realize that that wasn't the case. And so we ultimately, started in the spring of 2009, Chris and I started going and filming like local, like lacrosse games. So like New Canaan playing wow. Norwalk, or Darien playing Greenwich, or whoever it might be. And those customers were like loving it, because we would take that video, we would edit it to a highlight reel, we would put it on their profile, and they'd then send it to coaches. And they would go, this is amazing, because I can just sit behind my desk and just send this video off to any school I want to. And so with that learning, we started going to these different recruiting events that exist and say, hey, can we come and film the recruiting event? And so if, Drury's going to Top 205, you could then buy the film from Top 205 and then get that film edited so you can send it to coaches.
Sadly, Drury didn't go to Top 205, but... Keep going. I like the aspiration.
And so, we really kind of realized that our miscalculation was that the video wasn't readily available to families. And so we kind of filled that void. We never wanted to be like at our peak of like events. We were doing 100 plus events that required, myself or Chris or someone from like our interns. We had a bunch of interns in the summer, but like, we really ran ourselves ragged in kind of building up this event presence, because it was our way of generating revenue, because we knew we could sell the film to the family, and the family would then put the highlight reel on the platform, and they send the highlight reel to coaches using the platform, and they'd go, oh my God, this is amazing. And so that was kind of the first iteration of the product.
When did you start feeling this strain of trying to like scale that? And it sounded like, you all were hitting that.
Yeah, we got to like 2013, so we've been at it for about 5 years. And at that point, like the business was in decent shape. We were making money, but what kind of had happened, which we didn't really want to happen, was we became more of like a filming outfit and less of a technology company. So we had all these relationships with all these events that if you wanted the film, you had to buy it from us. And so consumer was thinking it of as like, oh, I buy the film from these Lacrosse Recruits guys, and they also have the highlight reels and this other stuff. But we wanted to flip it. We wanted it to be the platform is the thing, and the film is just part of that kind of experience. But to the consumer, it was kind of getting like a knocked down into like, oh, if you pay $250, you get the film and the highlight reel and also this lacrosse recruits thing, whatever that is. And so that didn't sit well with us. And also we were getting pretty burnt out because, you know, Jory might start paying us on a yearly basis when he was a freshman. And so you might pay us freshman, sophomore, junior year, but then you go to college and I'm never going to see another dollar from you again. But one thing we learned as we started to get more and more customers was if you're an elite athlete, now these air quotes, you're playing on one of these travel teams. And so we thought, if we sold to the travel team doesn't go away. The kids rotate through the travel team, but the travel team doesn't go away. And so 2013-ish, we started kind of kicking around the idea, talking to different clubs. And in 2015, we raised a little money to essentially run at that vision of, well, let's build a software team and sell the software into the travel teams. So sell it into the travel soccer team, sell it into the travel lacrosse team, sell it into the travel volleyball team.
When you say sell into, do you mean that the team is the customer, or you're selling through them, but ultimately to the end student as well, or both?
Yeah, so it's a good question. So ultimately the club is buying, or the travel team is buying licenses on a per team basis. So they're saying, I have five teams that are recruiting age. I want them all to be on Sports Recruits. And each kid gets access to this suite of tools to manage their process. But the organization also gets a suite of tools to keep an eye on all those kids' efforts. So think of like a VP of sales logging into Salesforce to look at the efforts of all of their, you know, sales reps. A similar kind of example for some people listening that might make more sense. But what you're getting at is something we're still fighting with today, which is we're ultimately trying to find more efficient ways to get to that family. And trying to get to you directly involves maybe I'm doing paid search on Google, maybe I'm doing Facebook ads, maybe I'm sponsoring different events. Like I could be doing a million different things to get to Jory's family. But if I just sell into that club, like I'll get Jory as part of landing that club. And so it was a really efficient way to really get to that wallet of the family. That also recurs because when Jory goes to school or goes to college, I just get that eighth grader rising up and then they're going to renew their license each year. That was a real turning point for us, which was 2015, which is when we started selling to teams.
It feels like a super efficient customer acquisition node. If you get in there and you convince the club you're the right partner, there's recurring need and you're getting a bunch of customers in that single one node or that one sale.
The other side of it too is, and we didn't really appreciate this maybe as much as we do now, but when you're selling into clubs, we're operating a marketplace, right? College coaches on one side, athletes on the other. For the college coaches, the more athletes they can have on the athlete side of the marketplace, the more valuable it is to them because the more potential recruits there are. And so when we were just kind of had a kind of traditional B2C business where people just signed up on their own and paid us directly, it takes a while to grow the athlete side because you're losing 25% of your kids every year. But when you're signing up clubs, we sign up clubs that are one team that's only 20 kids. We sign up clubs that are 1,000 kids in one shot on the soccer side. So you can really grow the athlete side really fast if you get the sales motion dialed in, which then, you know, immediately gets the attention of the college coaches because you're going from right now there's, you know, 500,000 families on the platform. So depending on sport, you know, wow, you're in a place as a college coach where any kid you're going to want to recruit is on this platform. So you could kind of really develop the supply side of the marketplace for the coaches a lot faster by selling directly into the teams.
Wow. That's fascinating. I didn't even think of it as it makes total sense. It's a platform, you know, or a marketplace with lock-in on both sides. What from the kind of the coach or the recruiter's perspective, I guess, is it the coach that's doing the recruiting or does he have a recruiting staff or does it depend on the school? Like, and what does it look like from his or her perspective? They go on and they are able to filter for different things, or how does that side of it work?
Yeah. So the college coaches get everything you would imagine someone on that side of the marketplace gets. So they can, you know, filter all of the athletes down to whatever they're interested in. So if you're a school that has a specific academic profile and you know that an SAT score of X is needed to really go talk to admissions about a kid. You can filter every kid down to just the athletes that meet that criteria. We also have a new-ish feature that is really kind of been pretty powerful to both sides of the marketplace, which is allowing coaches to actually post their specific roster needs. So if you're a program and you know you need a goalie, post it. So say I need a goalie from the class of 2025. And even better, if you know that goalie needs academic requirements, post that as well. Because on the athlete side, I can actually log in based off of what's on my profile. I could say, show me all of my matches. And if I have, let's say, not great grades, and Princeton has posted a need for a goalie, I'm not going to match with that because I'm not going to match with the grades they posted. And so we can save both sides a lot of heartache if we can make the information and increase the transparency to both sides, so that I'm not wasting my time sending Princeton a message, and I'm not wasting Princeton's time opening that message and reading that message just to see that I don't have the grades to go to their school. And so our selling point to both sides in the marketplace is, you know, hey, if we work together, we can make the process better for both sides, where student athletes aren't wasting their time on schools that are not a good fit for them or don't have a roster need for them. But also coaches aren't taking all of this inbound, this tidal wave of inbound from kids that don't have the academic profile to play at their school. I think that's our goal, is that just take as much of the inefficiencies out of this process. It's stressful enough, it's expensive enough. And if we could just, you know, improve some of the way the data is shared between the two groups, the process could be a lot more enjoyable for both sides.
Yeah, that's fascinating. What a cool business. And it feels like there's been a few of these key inflection points in the business. One being, you know, you realize that video was kind of, you know, an unlock. And then another being going through the clubs as kind of customer acquisition nodes. Were there any other, I mean, those are two fundamental like business changers. Were there any others along the journey that were those the two? I mean, those are clearly two big ones. Are there any others that were kind of big transitional points for the business?
You know, getting out from behind our computer when people weren't buying and like talking to lots of people, like really helped us get to the bottom of like the missing piece here is not your product. It's not you guys, your team. It's the fact that I don't have this video. And so us understanding that, you know, we could have stayed behind the computer and, you know, tinkered with all sorts of spreadsheets and wouldn't until we went blue in the face. But, you know, we really got out there and talked to a lot of people. So I think that was the learning there. The second, which obviously it's funny that we never even like really considered the natural churn that was built into our business when we launched it. We just figured there were so many customers, who cares? We'll just go get them all. But yeah, I mean, figuring out the club piece was big. And I think the more recent thing that we're really excited about is now the video piece is actually flipped on its head, where there's all these amazing products you can buy as a team to capture video. And so we've been working really hard to build relationships with all of those different, let's call it video capture companies, if you will, so that if you're a team using one of those products to capture your game's action, your team's action, that we make it as easy as possible to get that video onto sports recruits for recruiting purposes. Because a lot of these video capture products are capturing video for coaching purposes, not necessarily for recruiting purposes, but the big thing we've been working on over the last few years is just making sure that we have API integrations with as many of those video capture companies as possible, so that that video can stream right into the platform. So I think the beautiful thing about all this time we've been doing this is that 2009, we went out and started filming ourselves and then, you know, building event relationships to get film. You know, we're almost 15 years later and we're still trying to just find easier, more efficient ways to get video on the platform. So, you know, some things change and some things stay the same. And in our case, it's just kind of this video, not problem, but this challenge, I guess, is just, you know, how can we make it super easy for athletes to get video on the platform? Because if you're a college coach, that's what you want. You would love to go look at Jory's grades. Those are great. They were great. But I really need to see some video to see if he can play at my school.
What an awesome example, too, of you guys kind of like doing the hard thing, like the unscalable hard thing to get the flywheel going, right? Like going out and taking the videos was not the scalable like tech thing, but it was what got the flywheel going. And now you've got the flywheel spinning and some pretty good like head start and moat that's really hard to catch up with because you've got this two-sided thing. You're embedded with all these teams and things like that. And now the video aspect of it is becoming less important for you all to do. And you can almost like start outsourcing that and plugging that into the flywheel you guys have got and the head start you guys have got. So it's a great example in my mind of the dividends that are paid to doing the hard, unscalable thing to get something going to like feed a business. And then once you get that flywheel going, it kind of takes off from there. So that's awesome. That's pretty cool. Full circle thing with the video now being almost not outsourceable, but you don't need to, that's not a rate limiter for you guys.
No, I mean, in some of the stuff happening in the video space is really like there's a lot of AI like actually helping with, you know, there's a lot of AI hype going on, but there's actually a lot of AI within these video companies that are doing some really cool stuff. So yeah, I mean, for us, it sure beats being out in the hot sun, you know, operating a video camera. And, you know, at our peak, we had, you know, probably 400 or so videographers, you know, on a 1099 basis that Wow. we would plug in to these different events. And we were running ragged, you know, all summer long and all fall. But, you know, a lot
just
of
just like your caddying days, you know, you gotta get out there and carry the bag for a little while.
Yeah. I mean, there was That's no awesome. Other way for us to do it, because otherwise we weren't going to make any revenue. So we had to go out and get these film contracts from these event companies. And then we had to hire these videographers. But yeah, I mean, we made it out the other side.
That's awesome. Before I get to kind of my traditional last question that I ask everyone, you know, where's the business now? Where are you all headed? What are you most excited about? What does the future look like for you and for Chris and for sports recruits? You know, what are you most looking forward to?
I think the national signing day just happened. For those that don't follow that kind of stuff, but essentially it's the day in November where the kids that are currently seniors can like actually put pen to paper on these commitments that some of them made, you know, 2 years ago. So it's really empowering as sports recruits to see, you know, everyone tagging us in their posts that used our product, you know, during their recruiting journey. But the thing that I think we're most excited about is these video products integrating with sports recruits, you know, really levels the proverbial playing field a little bit. If you've read anything about recruiting, you'll probably see that or club sports, it's very expensive, excludes a lot of kids from it. A lot of athletes that really could probably thrive at the college level are opting out at a younger age. And one of those reasons is because of the travel that goes into it. You know, if you're a soccer player in Connecticut, you might be getting on a plane multiple times a year to fly to California. And in some cases, you might get to California and play a team from New Jersey. And I think as this video gets better and better, and as our product integrates with these companies more so, hopefully the barriers to joining some of these clubs come down as travel becomes less and less needed. Because if you're a college coach and you can get 4K video of, you know, Drury playing soccer, you might not need to be there. You can just watch Drury's video. So we're really excited to play that role of, you know, again, riding the wave of all this great video and hopefully allowing more and more student athletes access to, you know, exposure to college coaches that you shouldn't have to get on a plane to go to a recruiting event to be recruited. You know, the internet is very good at helping one group evaluate another. Dating apps, like you can, you know, the list goes on LinkedIn, like there's really no reason. So that's what I'm most excited for in the near term is working with all these video companies to make sure that when that kid makes that really good play, that play gets put front and center in front of the college coaches, regardless of where that athlete is from or what club they do or don't play for, or whatever, all the other crap that might happen. If that player has the ability to help a college team, that's all the college coach cares about, which I think is pretty fun part of, you know, what we get to do each day.
Man, that is, that's awesome. It's so cool that you all have found and effectively kind of like built this niche and then over the years defined how it works and made it a lot more efficient and a lot more kind of open. So that's awesome. Sadly, I don't think that would change how many coaches would be interested in watching my video in particular, but you know, it's all good. Even you guys can't help me. So it's all good. The last question I ask everyone on the show is a two-part question. It's a little bit nerdy, but it's modeled after like a take a penny, leave a penny dish at a convenience store, if you're familiar with that. And so on the leave a penny side, I always ask, what is something specific, either a business insight or a trick or a book or a habit or something that has been helpful to you that you'd be willing to share with the community? And then on the flip side, I'm also going to ask you, what is one thing that the community could do to help support, you know, either your business or yourself or something you're interested in as well. So I'd love to hear your thoughts on both of those.
For the first one, you know, the interesting kind of caveat to our story is that we've raised, you know, very little money. We've raised about $2 million of equity the entire life cycle of our business. And, you know, if you look at 2018 till today, which is, you know, for those listening, it's November of 2023, you know, there was a lot of weird stuff happening inside of technology companies. And there were moments where, you know, we had friends that started businesses that would raise all kinds of money and be all over TechCrunch. And, you know, we're over here kind of pounding away, doing all sorts of like ridiculous stuff to keep the lights on. And there were opportunities over the life cycle of business to raise more money that we just kind of realized like it wasn't what the amount of money that we would traditionally raise in a, whatever you want to call it, a round, just wouldn't be healthy for how we saw our business growing. And one of the books that I read throughout that time was called Small Giants, which is I actually sent to Jory. I was surprised he hadn't heard about it before, but it's this guy named Bo Burlingame wrote it. And he essentially highlights or looks into a bunch of different businesses, Anchor Beer, Cliff Bar, Danny Meyer's restaurant group, Ziegerman's, which is a big deli operation out of Ann Arbor, all sorts of different businesses, shapes and sizes, you know, essentially highlights the fact that like not every business needs to be this massive thing that is, you know, has press every day to, you know, to be quote unquote successful. So I remember reading that at a point in time where, you know, we probably needed to raise more money because of the way things were scaling, but we didn't necessarily know whether that was the right fit for us. And reading that book gave me some kind of, I guess, appreciation for kind of doing it your way. And you're really you as the entrepreneur, really are the only ones that know your business and your space as well as you do. So if you know your business is a business that is going to grow at a certain amount and that doesn't jive with the group that you might raise money from, you probably shouldn't do that. And so I think this book helped kind of crystallize that for my business partner and I.
Yeah, that's awesome.
Unfortunately, the postscript is Anchor Beer ended up raising money and then I think it's ceased to exist now. So Bo needs to write a postscript to Anchor Brewing, which is that great brewery out of San Francisco.
Or maybe that like just reinforces the story, right?
Maybe
they didn't need that money and
taste changed too. Less people are drinking beer. And then the take a penny. I mean, if anyone's listening and has a student athlete, I could help sign them up, get them set up with a Sports Recruits account, you know, reach out. I would love for some listener to have someone in their family use our product and hopefully positively impact their trajectory in life.
Awesome. Well, thank you, Matt, for taking the time. This has been great. I always we've known each other for, I'm not going to do the math because it will be embarrassing to both of us, but for many years. And I had no idea in particular about the caddying and your experience there, but on a number of fronts. So this is always fun for me too, to kind of do a stroll down memory lane and to get to know folks better and their stories better. So I appreciate you taking the time.
Thanks for having me, Jordan. I look forward to following everything going on with Enduring.
Thanks everyone for joining us. We hope you enjoyed the episode. To join the Built to Outlast community and access episodes, show notes, and other community resources, please visit builttooutlast.com. If you have or know a business that may be sold and care who the buyer is, or want to build a business and care who you do it with, please visit enduring.co to learn more about us, our long-term approach, and our holding company.